Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast, Sexual Orientation and Title VII edition. I'm your host, Grace Gotchling. On October 8, 2019, the U.S. Supreme Court heard argument in two consolidated cases asking whether discrimination because of sex, which is prohibited by Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, includes discrimination based on sexual orientation. In Altitude Express, Incorporated v. Zarda, a gay skydiving instructor, Donald Zarda, was fired after a female client with whom he was preparing a tandem jump alleged that he had touched her inappropriately, though he had disclosed his sexual orientation to protest that his intentions were not sexual. His lawsuit alleged that his employer discriminated against him because he was honest about his sexual orientation and did not conform to a, quote, straight, male, macho stereotype. In Bostock v. Clayton County, Georgia, Gerald Bostock, a gay man who worked as a child welfare services coordinator for the Clayton County Juvenile Court System, was fired after Clayton County learned of his sexual orientation, his participation in a gay recreational softball league, and his promotion of volunteer opportunities with the county to league members. His lawsuit alleged that the county falsely accused him of mismanaging public funds as a pretext for discharging him, with the real reason being his sexual orientation. The U.S. Court of Appeals in these cases reached mutually exclusive interpretations of Title VII's language, prohibiting discrimination because of sex. In Zarda, the Second Circuit, sitting en banc, overruled its prior case law to conclude that Title VII prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation. In Bostock, however, the 11th Circuit followed its long-standing precedent that Title VII does not support an action for sexual orientation discrimination. The U.S. Supreme Court subsequently granted cert in both cases to clarify whether discrimination against an employee because of sexual orientation constitutes prohibited employment discrimination because of sex within the meaning of Title VII. And now, to discuss the cases, we have John J. Bursch, owner of Bursch Law, PLLC. Please note that Mr. Bursch argued a related Title VII case, Harris Funeral Homes v. EEOC, before the Supreme Court this term.
Starting with the Zarda and Bostock cases, because they were argued first, they both involved the question of whether Title VII's prohibition on discrimination because of sex includes differential treatment of employers based on their sexual orientation. The Bostock case involved a county government which terminated an employee who alleges that the reason for that termination was that the employer found out he played for a gay softball team and then assumed that he was gay, which is an identity that he claims, has now sued claiming that is sex discrimination under Title VII. The employer moved for a motion to dismiss and prevailed because 11th Circuit precedent barred claims based on sexual orientation brought under Title VII. Zarda was a little more complicated. It involved a male skydiver who, while on a fall with a female customer, was alleged to have inappropriately touched her, defended himself by saying, "You don't need to worry about me, I'm gay," and was subsequently fired. The employer claimed that the termination was a result of the inappropriate touching. The employer said it was because he had said he was gay. The court initially went to trial on some claims, including a state law claim of discrimination based on sexual orientation, on which the company prevailed. But the Second Circuit later recognized that there was independent cause of action under Title VII for discrimination in employment based on sexual orientation, and it concluded that that claim would be litigated differently than the state claim that had already been tried to a jury. So the court accepted both of those cases. Harris Funeral Homes, the case that I argued, involves a similar question, prohibition on discrimination because of sex, in the context of gender identity. In our case, Harris Funeral Homes is a fifth-generation family business that has been serving grieving families in the Detroit area for more than 100 years. It has codes of conduct and sex-specific dress codes to ensure that its clients can focus on processing their grief rather than on the funeral home and its employees. In 2007, the funeral home hired a male employee to serve as a funeral director, the face of the funeral home. The funeral directors interact with the grieving clients in removing the body, assisting in organizing and putting together the memorial service, and then participating in that service as well. The employee agreed to abide by all of the employer's policies and did follow them, including the sex-specific dress code, for nearly 6 years. Then the employee approached the funeral home owner with a letter that said that the employee was going to be going on a two-week vacation, and when the employee came back, would be dressing and presenting as a woman when working with funeral home clients. The funeral home director considered that request, obviously was very concerned for the employee and the employee's wife, also considered the needs and concerns of other female employees, including an 80-year-old woman who would all be sharing a restroom with the employee at the site where the employee worked, and plus the interests of the grieving clients, and ultimately considered that he would not be able to agree to that request. The EEOC sued on the employee's behalf, again claiming that this was sex discrimination under Title VII. The funeral home defended on the ground that it was merely applying a sex-specific dress code, which the EEOC's own compliance manual expressly allows, and that doing so based on biological sex was not sex discrimination, and the court granted the cert petition in that case as well. So there are two overlapping issues in the three cases. The first is whether you can prove a straight-up claim of sex discrimination based on these categories on account of the language prohibiting discrimination because of sex. The second issue is whether you can assert a similar claim based on notions of sex stereotyping, and I'll briefly describe where that comes from. The U.S. Supreme Court decided a case called Price Waterhouse. Price Waterhouse itself wasn't an opinion about stereotyping, but it did mention it, and that's kind of what created the concept. The case itself was to determine the burden of proof in a mixed motive case, and in describing that, they also talked about the stereotypes that were used to keep Ann Hopkins, an accountant at a large accounting firm, from joining the partnership. And specifically, there were stereotypes that were made about Ann and how macho she acted. And this put Ann in a catch-22 because there were male employees at the accounting firm who were rewarded for being macho, but she was being penalized for it. There was also substantial evidence of sex discrimination in that case, wholly aside from the sex stereotyping. The partnership was virtually all male. Of the 88 employees who were coming up for consideration for partnership, Ann was only the one woman out of the 88-member class, and there were lots of derogatory comments made about women in the record. And so what the Supreme Court said was not that there is an independent cause of action for sex stereotyping, but that sex stereotyping can be used as evidence to prove a claim of sex discrimination. There is a third issue in the two sexual orientation cases that is not present in the gender identity case, and that is an association claim. And it's basically premised on the idea that an employer would not be able to fire an employee for being in an interracial marriage because that would be because of race. And the claim in those cases is that likewise, someone who has a same-sex attraction should not be able to be fired or otherwise treated adversely in employment because they have an attraction to someone of the same sex rather than the opposite sex. And so that kind of sets the stage for the U.S. Supreme Court arguments. So as I mentioned, the Zarda and the Bostic cases, Pam Carlin from the Stanford Supreme Court Clinic argued on behalf of both of the employees. And she made the point that but for the sex of the employees, they would not have been fired. The analogy that she used is that if you had a female employee who was married to someone named Bill, and Professor Carlin didn't articulate this, but she was assuming that Bill was a male. So if a female employee was married to Bill, they would not be fired. But if there was a male employee who was married to Bill, they would be fired. Therefore, the only differentiation between those two things was the sex of the employee. Justice Ginsburg started the questioning under the U.S. Supreme Court's new format, where the advocates now have a two-minute free fire zone where they can talk. And she asked about whether this kind of discrimination based on sexual orientation would have been in Congress's mind at the time that Title VII was enacted in 1964. And Professor Carlin explained correctly, I think, that the claim wouldn't necessarily have to be in Congress's mind. What we're looking at is the plain language of the text. And so what matters is whether sex discrimination encompasses discrimination or adverse treatment based on sexual orientation. And that's exactly what the U.S. Supreme Court has held in several Title VII cases, most specifically in holding that harassment claims can be brought under Title VII. It's unlikely that there were any legislators or Congress people in 1964 who were thinking of sex harassment when they were banning sex discrimination. But if you think about sex discrimination, as the Supreme Court always has, as treating women worse than men, at least similarly situated men, or vice versa, then sex harassment certainly fits that rubric. So then Chief Justice Roberts jumped in with a question about judicial updating. And this is a concept that was introduced by Judge Posner in a concurrence in the Seventh Circuit opinion in Hively, which was the very first circuit court to recognize that you could bring a claim based on your sexual orientation under Title VII. Judge Posner has been widely criticized by folks on both sides of the legal issues for describing this as judicial updating. For those supporting the employers, the notion is that the courts should never be in the business of judicial updating anything. Only Congress can do that. For those supporting the employees in these cases, the contention is that what the Seventh Circuit did and what later circuits did was not judicial updating at all, but rather simply applying the original public meaning of the statute. Professor Carlin referred to Judge Posner as a bit of a loose cannon as a jurist, which drew some pretty startling responses from some of the justices. And of course, she took the position that this was not updating, but merely simply applying the plain language of the statute. So then Chief Justice Roberts pivoted to the main question. If you have a policy that applies equally to male and females without regard to sex, how can that ever be sex discrimination as the Supreme Court decided it? And this reflected the briefing of the employers and of the U.S. government as an amicus in support of the employers, that the proper comparison in a case like this is not a male employee who is in a male relationship and a female employee with someone who is in a male relationship, but rather a male and a female who both are in a same-sex relationship. And that when you compare those two individuals, you can't say that women are being treated worse than men or men are being treated worse than women. Instead, the differentiator is employees who are experiencing same-sex attractions as opposed to opposite-sex attractions. And sexual orientation is a classification that Congress has considered adding to Title VII on approximately 50 occasions and has never done so. Professor Carlin's response to that is that to so conclude would be to stereotype, because it assumes that everybody should be attracted to the opposite sex, not their same sex. Now, at this point, Justice Ginsburg jumped in, and she made the point that unlike race, certain distinctions require treating males and females differently. And Professor Carlin's response to that is that Congress has provided for that with the BFOQ exception. The BFOQ portion of Title VII is a bona fide occupational qualification. And as Justice Ginsburg pointed out much later in the Harris Funeral Homes argument, BFOQs have traditionally been construed very narrowly by courts, because if they're given an expansive reading, it's to the disadvantage of women. So typically they would apply in a case where, because of pure biological and physiological differences, it's required to have a male in a position rather than a female, or vice versa. So for example, if you had a job that required you to be able to lift 200 pounds and males were the only ones who were qualified to do the 200-pound lifting because female employees or applicants weren't capable of doing that, the employer could use only males in that position, and that would not be sex discrimination. But that response really didn't get to the point that Justice Ginsburg was making, that even in non-BFOQ contexts, there are distinctions between men and women that might require different treatment, and that differential treatment is not necessarily discriminatory treatment. And so it was Justice Gorsuch then who then brought that point home by referencing gender-specific school uniforms and bathrooms, issues where men and women are treated separately and no one considers those to be sex discrimination because there's no burden on one or the other that is unfair or undue. In other words, women aren't treated worse than men or vice versa. And so interestingly, as a very long colloquy then went back and forth on the issue of bathrooms and dress codes, Professor Carlin, while advocating for her clients, really threw under the bus the claims of the employee in the Harris Funeral Homes case. She made clear that for purposes of her argument, there was nothing wrong with distinguishing between males and females when it came to privacy facilities or even dress codes, as long as one sex was not burdened more than the other. So at this point, Justice Alito jumped into the fray for the first time and talked about what a big, important policy issue this is, and that it's one that really distinctly belongs in the legislative branch, not the judicial branch. And he cited specifically the Equality Act, which the U.S. House of Representatives has already passed but has stalled in the Senate, as an example where Congress is redefining sex to include sexual orientation and gender identity across the board. And this was the point where Professor Carlin made the comment about Judge Posner being a loose cannon. There were also some discussions between Professor Carlin and the Chief Justice involving religious exemptions when extending, and how the ministerial exception, co-religionist exception, Title VII's own religion exemption would apply to these situations. Given the amount of time that the court and the advocates had, they weren't able to explore that in detail. So just a quick side note on that as it came out in the briefing. The ministerial exception, obviously, is a very limited one for only religious entities as employers, and it would not apply to employers in the private context, even those who are religiously motivated in the work that they do. And the co-religionist exemption would work the exact same way. What's more, RFRA, which might arguably be applied in a situation like this to protect a religiously motivated employer who is not a religious organization, it's not clear that would apply. There's a circuit split over RFRA's application in a case where you have a purely private plaintiff and defendant. So in the Zarda and Bostet cases, there is no government entity, and some circuits would say RFRA does not apply. And even in the case of Harris Funeral Homes, where the EEOC was the original party, and I should have explained that the federal government is now on the funeral home side, but the ACLU intervened on the employee's behalf in the Sixth Circuit and continues to press that case forward. But even in that context, where everyone would agree that Title VII could apply to the situation, the Sixth Circuit concluded that RFRA did not protect the funeral home's religious beliefs in this context. And so if the justices are concerned about protecting religious liberty in this context, and Chief Justice Roberts clearly seemed to be concerned about that, none of the protections that might otherwise be available is likely to be of much safety for religiously motivated employers. Before I get to the most interesting part in the very end, I still need to talk about Jeff Harris, who was the attorney who represented the employers. So he stood up, and with his 2 minutes, he pushed the point that Wisconsin was the very first state to add transgender and sexual orientation protections to state law back in the 1980s. And at the time, it was widely celebrated as a historic and groundbreaking event, as have other state and local laws that have added protection for those classifications. He said, "It would be unusual indeed to say that all of those things were completely superfluous and unnecessary if, in fact, Congress had prohibited discrimination based on sexual orientation and transgender status all the way back in 1964 when Title VII was enacted." Justice Sotomayor was the first one to jump in as soon as Mr. Harris's 2 minutes ran out, and she immediately raised the hypothetical of a male employee with a sewing hobby. And she asked if the employer thought that the man who sewed was gay and then terminated for that reason, would that be a mixed motive termination involving both sex and sexual orientation that would be actionable under Title VII? Mr. Harris responded that was conflating the issues of causation and injury, and he doubled down on the argument that sexual orientation and sex are two different classifications. Justice Ginsburg then brought up the OnCal case. OnCal was a case that the court decided unanimously in favor of an employee in a Title VII case. It's been used by both sides in the litigation. For the plaintiffs, it's Justice Scalia's statement in the controlling opinion that when we're interpreting a statute, we don't necessarily limit ourselves to the evil that was in the minds of the legislators at the time of the enactment. Instead, we simply look at the original public meaning and ask whether the cause of action today falls within the parameters. And so in that case, It was a man who was claiming same-sex sexual harassment by a supervisor, and Justice Scalia concluded that that individual was protected by Title VII, even though it's doubtful that anyone in Congress at the time of Title VII's enactment would have thought that such a claim was covered. What the employers point to in ONCAL is that Justice Scalia elaborated on why that would be so. And he said, well, if you had a same-sex attracted supervisor, which was the situation in ONCAL, they would be treating differently, disadvantageously, the male employee compared to a woman employee if they had been in that same situation. And so the ultimate inquiry that ONCAL announced, that women have to be treated worse than men or men worse than women, was no different than in any other case. And that's how that scenario fit in there, just like sexual harassment. So what Justice Ginsburg asked Mr. Harris is whether the decision in ONCAL would have come out any differently if there were no women on the platforms. And the simple response to that is it doesn't matter whether there are women at the workplace. When you're comparing an employee to another employee to determine whether there has been disparate treatment based on sex, it's entirely appropriate to consider a hypothetical comparator, that is, someone who may not actually be at the company, but you ask yourself, what would the employer have done to them? And here the appropriate comparator to a male who is in a same-sex relationship is a woman who is in a same-sex relationship, and Mr. Harris's clients would have treated either one of those employees exactly the same. So after Mr. Harris was done, the Solicitor General, Noel Francisco, came to argue as amicus in support of the employers. And again, there was a long colloquy about using restrooms. And there were some questions by Justice Gorsuch that I think may have caused some in the media to be confused about where he stands on this case. Because what he was asking was whether a male who identified as a woman who wanted to use the female restroom, locker room, or shower at an employee would have any injury as a result of that. And the answer to that would presumably be yes. I think multiple justices and advocates acknowledge that. That sounds favorable to an employee who is trying to advance a claim based on transgender status, but in fact, Justice Gorsuch's point appears to be that if the court were to rule in favor of the plaintiffs in these cases, that that would wipe away the ability of employers to have sex-specific policies in the showers, restrooms, and locker rooms, or for that matter, in other respects as well, including sex-specific dress codes. That injury shows that it's impossible to cabin these cases in such a way that the plaintiffs can prevail without affecting all those sex-specific policies, which was a major point that the other side continued to press throughout the argument. So finally, we get to Pam Carlin, Professor Carlin, back on her rebuttal, and what I thought was the most interesting portion of the first hour of argument. She and Justice Alito went back and forth about a hypothetical that kind of morphed a little bit, where an employer treats someone disparately, disadvantageously, because of their sexual orientation without even knowing their sex. And in the most critical exchange of both hours of arguments, Professor Carlin admitted that that employee would lose. So consider the situation where the employer has an application, and it asks for the applicant's sex with a male box and a female box to check. And instead, the applicant crosses both of those out and simply says, I'm gay. The employer could choose not to hire that person, not having any idea whether they were a man or a woman. And so that really proved the Solicitor General's and Mr. Harris's point that sex and sexual orientation are two different classifications. They're independent concepts. And so when Professor Carlin then admitted that in the situation where the employer would take that action, not knowing the employee's sex, and said that they would lose, Justice Alito immediately responded, then it seems that your entire argument has fallen apart. And it certainly had. And so I don't think that portends well for the plaintiff's claim in that case.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.